Welcome, everyone. Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Our first meeting of the first short session of Oregon history. So a historic day, but same old committee. Same young committee.
I was going to say.
Okay, all right. Okay, we will start out by trying to set some parameters for ourselves.
Okay.
So I will open the organizational meeting for the purpose of adopting our rules.
Okay. Paul? Well, first, Madam Chair, you do have your same old staff. Dave Beck is here on school finance, and Corinne Gavette, our office manager, Christine Broniak, our property tax person, and Chris Alanak. And our new person for this session is Matt Davis, who's our committee assistant. So he's joined us for
Let the record show that it's the same great staff.
The same great staff and a new great one to add. So
yes, and Mazin's lurking around here somewhere, too. So you have in front of you the model committee rules, and those are all, they're pretty standard for all the committees. I'll just comment on two that always come up. One is the quorum, number one there, and of course remind you that you have four members, so it takes three for a quorum, but that only applies to work sessions, so public hearings, just one person could constitute a subcommittee for a quorum. The other one is number 17, which is the rule that we've been wrestling with for the last several sessions about requiring fiscal revenue impact statements before distributing or reviewed by the committee before there's any actions taken. Of course, we not only are your staff, but we also do all the revenue impacts for all the other committees. So we know that's an issue that sometimes it's hard to do, and we work as close as we can with fiscal. So that's one of the things that we'll try to get that as much as we can, that paperwork lined up for you for decisions.
Okay. Yep, Madam Chair.
Senator Telfer.
I was thinking maybe we should add a 19 that in this hearing room, we should have everybody move to the front of the room. It's like sitting in church. Everybody's in the back. I don't know if it's a quick exit or what.
Okay, we will take that under advisement. I think that's a controversial issue that needs to wait for the longer session. Okay. Senator Morse, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee rules for the 2012 session adopted February 3rd, 2012.
Senator Morse has moved to adopt the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee rules for the 2012 session. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay. Now we are going to open.
I don't know.
I'm going to go out of order here. If everyone is here, if someone's not here on Senate Bill 1519, please tell me right away. I'd like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1519. You are here for introductions today.
Chair
Old
Burdick.
Mazin.
Yeah, the old Mazin who is in charge of everything that has anything to do with vice.
Except in this instance, we deal with relaxation and comfort. This is transient lodging tax.
Well, but yes, I could say something, but I won't. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
We do a 1519?
Yes, we're going to go out of order.
And 1519, the bill attempts to redefine the tax collected at this stage. The lodging tax is 1% statewide imposed on the services or the lodging services provided by hotels, motels, conferences or conference halls, condominiums and houses that are rented for vacations and so on. This is not to mention that the local governments also have their own lodging taxes that is usually higher rates than the state 1%. This bill changes the definition of who collects the lodging tax. Presently, the ones who collect are the providers, which means the either the hotels, motels, or whoever provides the service. The bill defines a new definition, the intermediary and the lodging tax collector. And this is basically to capture that people who actually do not provide the service, but they actually collect the fees for the service itself. And by doing that, the tax collector becomes a different entity than the provider itself. So this is what this bill in a nutshell, and there is, of course, you would hear the different discussions on it.
Okay. I think we'll start off with Bill Perry. And Bill, is there anybody you wanted to come up with you? Okay.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, and most of you know I've been working on this issue for a little over a year now. And they're going to pass around my testimony, so I won't read it. I know in the tax committee you can get a lot of boring testimony, so we'll hopefully move away from that. I thought I would, in the packet, I've included the way a couple other states have addressed this. There's Minnesota kind of changed. It wasn't necessarily a bill, but I would say they redefined a bunch of different tax stuff there. And there's a Florida bill. And there's been a lot of discussion in the last couple of days about lawsuits. And I would say they're, from my perspective, they're kind of irrelevant for a couple of different reasons. First of all, as you well know, taxes in different states are different. And most places have a sales taxes, so some of the sales taxes are written in, some of them are excise taxes, but tax codes in different states is just different. None of the cases that I'm aware of have dealt with federal law or federal trade law. It's just how you define who pays the tax and how it gets paid. That's the fundamental argument that I think a lot of this revolves around. We obviously established the statewide tax in 2003. Some of you were part of that discussion. And this issue never specifically came up that I could recall. I think a lot of us believe that you paid on the retail rate, but what exactly is the retail rate is not defined in law. And so could the state of Oregon sue right now and say they owe us the taxes? They could. And if you look at a historical perspective, meaning you look across the states of all the local cases, the government tends to win about 60 to 65% of these cases. The OTCs, which are online travel companies, tend to win about 35 to 40. So that's your ratio. Once again, all tax laws are different. Now, since
Bill, why don't you back up and just kind of frame the issue, what the issue is.
Okay, sorry about that. As of right now, you can purchase a room. If you go to the hotel and purchase a room, the tax is paid on the full amount, whatever you pay to the hotel. The marketplace has kind of changed in the last few years to where online travel companies are more active. Expedia, Travelocity, Priceline, you see all these advertisements. They tend to have an agreement based on franchises or either a director agreement that basically says, we're going to purchase the room at $80. So they give the hotel the $80 and whatever the tax rate is, say it's 10%, so they give them $88. $80 for the room, $8 for the tax. Then they turn around and they sell the room for X amount, say $100. And then they collect all the taxes and everything else on that $100. And so basically they keep whatever is the portion above the $88. What this bill defines is, doesn't matter who sells it or how it gets sold, is whatever the consumer pays is now the rate that the taxes are collected on, both the state and the local taxes. So if you sell to the consumer for $100 and the tax rate is $10, then, or 10%, then you collect $10 on top of that. So it basically says we're not going off the wholesale rate, we're going off the retail rate. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And then, but when the hotel sells it to the intermediary, does the hotel collect the tax too?
Well, that's the question. When you look at, I got the bill here. When you look at the bottom of page 2, which is just deals with the state tax, you look at C. Well, they define tax collector can either be the lodging provider or the lodging intermediary. I'm going to have problems pronouncing that word. I'll tell you that right now. The tax shall be collected by the transient lodging collector that receives the consideration. So whoever under there receives the money from the consumer, they're supposed to remit it to the governing body, the Department of Revenue in this case, and then all of the money will be. And then obviously that just deals with the state tax. The same language is at the bottom of page 5, which deals with the local taxes. So it's supposed to be basically the same, just two different collection mechanisms. Which, getting back to where I was, the thing that's changed dramatically since 2003 when we passed our law is the online travel companies have become more active. You add in the complication of how hotels are owned. You have individual operators, you have national chains, which are sometimes easier, but in that mix, kind of in the middle, you also have franchises that have franchise agreements with the nationals. You have property management companies, which don't own the property or aren't the franchise brand, but they manage the hotel under a franchise name. Since the online travel companies have taken off, you see a lot of the national hotels and the franchise brands are competing in that marketplace, too. So then they have online travel accounts, which they collect the tax on the full amount, even though the hotel is still only receiving a percentage, but the online travel companies don't. So you've added all this kind of what I would say confusion or complication to the process just when you look at Oregon since 2003. So as we move back, you know, and kind of what I was trying to accomplish last session is say, this was never part of the discussion in 2003. Most of you guys were here and voted on the bill one way or another. So I would say the law has never really been defined. So that's what we're asking for, is let's just define the law. Since this really wasn't part of the discussion, how should we deal with it as a state? So we have different options. We can either let it go and either kind of let the system currently handle, and we could say the Attorney General could sue to get an answer. It's one option. The other option is what I've recommended here, which is, let's just say it's the retail rate. Whatever the consumer pays is the retail rate, it becomes the rate to taxation. There is an amendment floating around of the Florida bill that basically says whatever the hotel receives is the taxable rate, so you treat all internet transactions the same. So now Hilton Garden Inn, all those get to operate the same way the OTCs do if they sell it at a federal level. So that would obviously reduce revenue. And so we basically are supporting this proportion. And one of the reasons why is, when you say why now, is first of all, it's getting complex, a lot of lawsuits. Other states are moving in this direction. Three states have passed a law to clarify because of the lawsuits. Second, you're going to have local governments sue different OTCs. Now, if they win, it doesn't change the process for the state. So if Salem decided they wanted to sue the OTC and they won, you would only collect it that way in Salem. You wouldn't collect a Marion County tax or a state tax. Those units would then have to sue to collect their taxes. And so you start to get this even further complicated mess. So what we're trying to do is say, here's the process for Oregon. Now, as you move forward, you look, you had a huge dip in the market in 2007 because of the economy. Now the market is starting to come back. Business travelers are coming back. This will add more tourism dollars so we can try to attract those people as the market starts to climb back. Hopefully it'll climb sooner than later, but this will basically increase collections of the current tax, so we'll have more money to market at the local level and at the state level. And the one thing we have accomplished well since 2003 is increased efforts by the local and the state government to have plans to market to tourists. So I mean, trying to keep this short because I know you have a lot of different issues, but I just think this is the right time. We need to clarify because this was really never part of the discussion in 2003. So let's establish what, as a legislative body, your intent was in 2003. I mean, you're looking back. Did this intend to say the retail rate or the wholesale rate, or do we want to let the courts decide? Because that's, I think, kind of where our options are. But I do think we all benefit if we increase the collections over the next couple of years because the market's starting to climb. So with that, I'll kind of move on, or we can take questions.
Why don't we finish the panel, and then we'll do the questions. Welcome.
Good morning, Senator Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, I am Pat McShane from Insight Hotel Management Group, and I represent our 400 employees and owners of 10 hotels located in Oregon. I think Bill has probably given you a much better overview than I could attempt to do. I really only have 2 points just to really reiterate for you, and that is the consumer is paying this tax. They're being charged this tax. They're remitting the tax to the OTAs. So the tax is being collected by the OTAs. The issue really is that they're only paying a portion of the tax, and we think that's the critical issue at a time when our industry is relying upon the efforts of the state and local organizations to market. It's just critical that all of those dollars get to the entities that need those dollars, as well as local governments for services and other things. So I am very supportive of this bill. I think it's very good for the state, very good for the tourism industry, and good for the jobs that it creates within our industry.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Davidson, and I have the privilege and pleasure of serving as the Executive Director of the Oregon Tourism Commission. I do want to state for the record that the Oregon Tourism Commission is currently neutral on this bill, and I know that Bill and Pat both know that as much as I'm sitting up here at this particular panel with them, because we collaborate very closely, obviously, with individual hotels, hotel chains, RV parks, campgrounds, and others throughout the state. We also cooperatively market with our online travel agency partners. We've done co-ops with Travelocity and others, because fundamentally our job is to create demand for travel to and within the state of Oregon to create that economic activity and to generate jobs for the state. As Bill mentioned, we did see, because of the economic downturn, we did see the collections from the 1% statewide lodging tax drop about 15%. A couple of years ago. It was very significant. We focused our efforts on making sure that our advertising campaigns did stay as fully funded as we could keep them, and made decisions to trim in other areas, including staffing, administration, and such, so that we could keep our advertising programs as whole as possible. We saw approximately 10.5% recovery last year. So for those folks that were referring to this as kind of a square root recovery, where we dropped off very quickly, recovered again then very sharply, and now we're seeing kind of slow, steady growth, so it looks like the square root sign that we all saw in eighth grade algebra, that's pretty much what we're experiencing here in Oregon as well. In our position of neutrality, I do think there's some context that would be valuable for me to be able to share with the committee this morning. One is estimates that have been done on what this might mean had been done for Oregon, and for Portland by a group called the National Online Travel Litigation Group. This was not something that we sought. This was not something that the State Attorney General's office sought, but rather this was something that was provided because of some of the activity that was happening across the country, and this group put together these estimates. Their estimates were that this change would generate approximately $621,000 annually at the state level in new 1% statewide lodging tax that would be collected, and approximately $955,000 annually for the city of Portland. The litigation that Bill referenced, my understanding is that to date there have been somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 lawsuits that have been filed at different levels across the country. Two have reached state Supreme Courts, to my knowledge, one in Georgia, one in South Carolina. In both cases, the Supreme Courts examined the merits of the case and decided in favor of state and local taxing jurisdictions and explained that they believe the OTCs owe tax on that retail rate. By the way, just for clarification, Travel Intermediary, OTC, Online Travel Company, and OTA, Online Travel Agency, for this conversation today, should be considered synonymous for the members of the committee. You'll just hear us use different acronyms probably throughout the day. Federal district courts and two federal circuit courts have decided against the tax. It appears from our review that all those decisions were expressly limited to specific language. That's where they had their issues. 16 cases were dismissed for procedural reasons, at least 5 were dismissed without prejudice, and at least 10 cases were settled outside of court. So that's a little of the background on some of the lawsuits that have been filed that we've been able to ascertain over the last couple of days. Bill also referenced some recent action, and the one that I'm most familiar with occurring most recently was indeed the state of Minnesota. Their legislature did pass a law last summer. It was enacted immediately, and our understanding is that their State Department of Revenue was then to begin collecting on the retail rate from the online travel companies immediately. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have. Thank you very much.
Okay, let me start. Bill, in the process of doing this tax, this your bill, would it be intended to just levy the tax once, but on the full price that the consumer is paying for the room?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, well, levy the tax once would be an accurate statement, but it does depend on who receives the money. So I'm assuming there are certain agreements where the hotel receives the original, in my earlier example, 80, and they collect the $8. Anything additionally on that would be collected or paid by whoever gets the money. That's why in the definition under C on page 2, it's basically collected by who receives the consideration.
Because there's also, as I understand it, just from conversation, we're going to be hearing from the OTCs or the OATs or the
APIs
or whatever soon. But it was my understanding that part of what they charge the consumer is a service fee. So would the tax be levied also on the service fee?
It would be basically based on whatever the end price is. So if they're saying a price on your bill, it basically said these are taxes and fees. And so anything that would be room price would be taxable. Anything that would be service and fees is outside of that.
Now, what do you mean by service and fees?
Well, that's, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, that's pretty much probably the crux of the argument is right there, is because I think they're collecting what they call taxes now,
right,
but they're only remitting on the wholesale price. They're keeping the tax on the end rate, so that is the question.
You would say that they're levying the tax on the whole thing, including their service fee.
Yes, I mean it all
then
depends on how
only paying the tax based on the what they pay the hotel.
It all depends on how it's written on the bill, but yes, I would agree with that.
And we will. Those folks will have a chance to elaborate on that. Other questions? Senator Hess.
Thank you. I think that would be helpful if we saw a breakdown of, if I picked up the phone and called Portland Marriott, and here's what it would be broken down, as opposed to if I went on Travelocity and got the same room at the same facility, and here's how those prices broke down, and then what the change would be with this. Just sort of a hypothetical real life snapshot, would I notice? I mean, would that be possible?
Let me make sure I understand. In other words, if you booked a room directly through one of the online travel agencies and booked same room, same conditions, directly with the hotel itself, is that the... Okay. What would happen under those circumstances is you would probably pay the same rate and the same taxes on top of that rate. What the tax that would be remitted to the state and local jurisdictions would be different, however. If you book the reservation directly with the hotel, let's say again $150 and a tax of 10%, the full $15 in essence would be distributed through the tax system. If you did the same thing through an OTA, there would be less taxes going to, in essence, the state and local jurisdictions. Does that?
I see that. That is this what we're trying to correct?
Yes.
And if so, then where could we see that breakdown of where it goes in, showing less and less here, more here?
Chair Burdick, Senator Haas, you'll probably not be able to see that breakdown because let me try it this way. Okay, you buy I'm going to go $100 because my math skills are not that quick. So you go $100 and a 10% tax. Your bill from Expedia is going to look exactly like your bill from his property.
Right.
Okay, now what you don't know as a consumer, or what we're not going to know, is how much did Expedia pay for that room? They probably paid $80, so they're keeping the $20. They're also, if they paid $80, they got $10 tax. They're only remitting $8 tax. They're keeping the $2. So we don't know that, because you'd have to know what the agreement was with the hotel on what the wholesale price is. And so if you got a bill from his property and you got a bill of that exact same room that was sold by the OTC, you would know it. You'd be able to compare it. But the bills to the consumer are going to look exactly the same, because they're, as near as we can tell, they're almost always selling for the same price.
So I didn't factor in the commission, if you will, that Expedia takes out.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's usually written agreements on what they charge in excess to the room, so you know that stuff. But clear as mud now. So I don't think the two bills to the consumer are going to look any different.
No.
From my vantage point.
Senator Telfer.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So it's kind of like the tax is paid by who buys the room initially. Who occupies the room is different. They pay the tax. So the difference between what the purchase price of buying the room versus occupying the room is more or less a service fee. The service of getting that room for the occupier of the room.
Yeah, I guess I don't know.
Travelocity buys a room for $80. They're the actual purchaser of the room initially. Then they sell that. It's like scamming tickets, but they they resell that room for somebody for $100.
Yeah.
And so that $20, excluding all the tax issues, is that the service fee, or is it the service fee?
Yeah, I'd say that's
the $2 difference in tax.
Yeah, that's their profit, because, I mean, they're taking a risk. They're buying rooms sometimes and not selling them and everything. So they need to make a profit or administration fees and everything else. So the question is, that's separate. It's just the question of, on the tax, do you pay what the wholesale rate or the consumer rate? Because, and like I said, my argument here is, ultimately, it's listed on the bill as on top of the room rate paid by the consumer. That's the way it's listed on the bill, and so that's the way we've always perceived the taxes to be paid. And so I guess we've kind of had this argument a couple of different fines. What does provider mean? The person who actually provides the room, or the person that sells it to the customer? And I think if we would have been specific in that in 2003, this probably wouldn't be a court question, but because that what does provider means never really been answered. And so that's what our argument here today is, whoever's providing that to the customer, whether it's the OTA or the hotel, doesn't matter. It's whoever sells it to the customer would be the provider in this particular example.
So if I could follow up on your question. So under your changes, the OTC or OTA would pay the tax on what they sold the room to the consumer.
Yes.
So if they didn't sell the room, would they pay no tax?
In most instances, they really don't sell a room until they have a buyer. So it's not like they're purchasing rooms in advance for potential use. They really only sell a room when a customer is online making the reservation. That's when their sale takes place. And if that doesn't happen, then there's no sale.
So under your system, they would not pay the tax to the hotel. They would levy the tax, and the hotel, they wouldn't pay a tax to the hotel? Because if they had to pay the tax to the hotel, and then they had to pay the full tax to the local governments and the state government, that's a double tax. And that's not what you mean, right? You just wanted to pay the tax once, I assume.
Correct. How the mechanics work is basically someone will make a reservation through an online travel agency. They'll make that. The online travel agency will charge them, in essence, the retail price or whatever price is available, usually through the franchisor or whatever the hotel is selling, add the tax onto that, bill that customer for that, and when the guest comes to check in, the guest will come in, check in, and then check out, and in essence, we will then bill the online travel agency, but we will bill the online travel agency at the agreed rate, which is lower. So they will, again, in the instance of Bill's example, we'll bill them the $80. They'll pay for the $80 plus the appropriate tax, but we'll have collected that, again, 15, 20% service fee, as well as
the tax on
the entire retail rate.
Got it. Okay. Now it makes sense. For one moment, it makes sense.
Well, it's not like who's on first.
Yeah.
And I will say that we're not the first state, this is Bill Perry again for the record, that have done this, and North Carolina's in, and it seems like we haven't had any glitches in the collection. So, like I said, I think that as more states move on, this has become is going to become clearer for most. But we haven't had any collection problems, per se, that I'm aware of in the states or cities that have started doing this.
Senator Morris.
Well, thank you. I'm still not clear. Who remits the tax?
This is Pat McShane again. Currently, the hotel remits the tax on the lesser amount.
Okay.
In other words, we will direct bill, or we will bill the online travel agent. They will pay us. We will then disperse the tax to the appropriate entities.
Okay. And if a block of rooms are purchased, the OTC does not remit the tax.
Usually they don't purchase a block of rooms. Again, they are made available as the hotel has them available to that particular channel. If they sell, fine. If they don't sell, there's no liability. So they're really not purchasing them until the customer steps up and says, I want to purchase something.
So you remit the tax on the sale price that you have made to the OTC.
Correct.
And the OTC then will assess the customer that same percentage tax but on a higher rate, and they keep the difference.
That's correct.
That's what you're saying.
That's correct.
Okay. Good deal.
Senator Morris is looking for a new investment here. Okay, other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. think we'll go to Chris Vick, Brenda Wilson, and Randy Tucker.
Good morning, Chair Burdick, other members of the committee. For the record, Chris Vick with the League of Oregon Cities. The League is an association representing all 242 cities across the state, and we are in full support of Senate Bill 1519 before you today. At the risk of further clouding things, I hope to be able to clarify and reiterate a couple points that the panel made before, but I will do so briefly and only try to add some value to the information you've already heard this morning. As Bill and the previous panel mentioned, there are really two claims from the OTC, online travel companies, about why this legislation should not be passed and this statute not clarified. One is the number of lawsuits that exist throughout the state, throughout the country, rather, and the other is a lack of understanding for their business model. First, to the lawsuit point, there are scores of lawsuits throughout the country. Those lawsuits are largely a reflection of the different local ordinances that cities adopted and are largely looking backwards to try and collect old taxes that could be owed that online travel companies have not paid. Because of the variety of different statutes and ordinances that are out there, there will be decisions made in favor of the local governments and against the local governments. A lot of these ordinances were adopted prior to the advent of the Internet, and certainly prior to the widespread usage of these online travel companies. So they're not necessarily a reflection of what this legislation is trying to do, which is simply clarify what we mean when we assess a transit lodging tax moving forward. And that it will do exactly that, and will henceforth require OTCs to pay the state and local transient lodging taxes on the retail price that they sell the rooms for. The second point is a lack of understanding about the OTC business model. As you guys just discussed, there's a discrepancy about the services that these online travel companies are providing and whether or not they should be assessed this transient lodging tax on the service, on the margin at which they're making money on these transactions. It should be pointed out that the advertising, marketing, booking, informational services that these companies are providing are really no different than the advertising, marketing, booking, and informational services that our local hotels are providing and are paying the tax on. So we wouldn't allow a Hilton to deduct their marketing expenses from the transient lodging tax that they impose on the people that buy their rooms. It's the service they provide. It's included in the retail rate. We believe that the same retail rate should be imposed for the services that the online travel companies are providing. Brenda Wilson from the City of Eugene is here to talk specifically about some of the demands that tourists place on local governments. Last year, this committee heard from representatives from the City of Ashland, Sisters, Bend, and Redmond about those significant demands. I'm not going to belabor the point. I'm sure you guys are well aware that the demands that tourists place on cities are not fully recouped by the revenues we receive from the transient lodging taxes. We believe that this change in statute would narrow that and would enable cities who are already facing significant budget cuts to continue to provide the level of services, the amenities that tourists expect when they travel to our cities. I know, just for the record, that the Association of Oregon Counties is also supportive of this legislation, so we encourage you to report it out favorably.
Thank you. Brenda?
Good morning, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Wilson. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Manager for the City of Eugene, and we are here in support of Senate Bill 1519 as well. As Chris stated, the City of Eugene has looked at the same national study that was mentioned in the previous testimony, and we estimate that we are losing approximately $50,000 a year right now because these transient room taxes are not being remitted to the city. We expect that number to grow as our regional travel agency, Travel Lane County, is embarking on an effort to market our area as the track and field capital of the world, which we already believe we are, especially with the upcoming 2012 Olympic trials coming to town. It does place a huge burden on local government to make sure that our city is welcoming, it's safe, it's easy to get around. And in response to Senator Haas's question about a breakdown of how this works and where the extra transient room tax that is lost goes, if you look at my testimony that you just received, in the middle of it is a what I hope is a simplified breakdown, and actually use the exact same numbers as Bill Perry, because my math skills aren't that good either, and I made it as simple as possible. But if you look at that, you can see that the additional $2 in tax that the customer actually pays does not go to the local jurisdiction. It stays with the online travel company, even though the customer has paid that. The same amount of money they would have paid had they gone directly to, say, the Hilton's website or the Best Western website. I'm going to cut it off right there. Again, we're in support of this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, questions from the committee? Oh, no. We're going to have one more, and then we'll have questions.
Good morning, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Randy Tucker, Metro Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I'll be very brief because I think most of the arguments have been made. The Metro Council supports Senate Bill 1519. Our interest has to do with, we don't actually collect the transient lodging tax, but we have a series of agreements with Multnomah County related to the Oregon Convention Center, the Portland Center for the Performing Arts, which we don't own, but we operate. We do own the convention center. And then, of course, the transit lodging tax supports other services like the Free Rail Zone, Regional Arts and Culture Council, and other things that are very important to the region. The formulas by which we receive transit lodging tax, I think, I don't understand them. I understand property tax compression a lot better, so they're complicated. But be happy to provide background data for you if you'd like to see the amount of money. It's in the single digits of millions of dollars that go to support the convention center. And it's a significant funding source for that facility, which doesn't internally make money, but which pumps tens or hundreds of millions of dollars into the regional economy. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Now we'll have questions. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Okay, now we'll have the industry come up. Margie Hoffman. I know.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Margie Hoffman, and I am here today representing both the Interactive Travel Services Association, so Expedia, Travelocity, and companies, Priceline, companies like that, and also the Independent Lodging Industry Association, which represents over 55 businesses here in the state of Oregon that are independently owned. First, they will hand out my testimony, but the first thing that I want to do is make sure that we're clear about online travel companies' business model, because some of what has been said here today is true, and some of what has been said here today does not speak to how our business model works. So if I log on to the Internet and I go to search for a hotel room that's available in the city of Salem from, the night of February 7th, the hotel agrees to allow the facilitator. So the online travel company's website then communicates with people who have signed up, businesses who have signed up to use our website in the city of Salem. The hotel then says, we have these rooms available at this rate. Those come up on the website, and the customer can then see what rooms are available for what rate. They book the hotel reservation, and the facilitator charges the credit card. The customer is charged for three things. They're charged for the rate at which the room was quoted by the hotel. They're charged for the transient lodging tax, both the state lodging tax and the local jurisdiction's lodging tax, on the rate of the room. And then they are charged a service fee for the online travel company to provide this service to businesses and customers. The hotel then invoices the facilitator for the room rate and the tax recovery. So, and then the facilitator retains only the service fee that we charge customers to book through an online travel company. The hotel then remits the occupancy tax to the state of Oregon. The proponents of this bill are correct in stating that there have been numerous court cases across the country where the issue has come up about several different pieces of whether or not online travel companies should be taxed for the services that they provide. Though those court cases are split, courts have unanimously found that never does an online travel company keep taxes that should be remitted to the state. So I just want to, you'll get a piece of paper that looks like this that walks through all of the court cases in which this has been documented publicly. I want to be very clear about what this bill does. This bill includes the service fee for online travel service for customers to use OTCs to book rooms. It allows that fee to be taxed. So right now, the only thing that's taxed in Oregon when people book rooms, be it direct through the hotel's website or be it through an online travel company, is the cost of that room. The Attorney General in a 2008 opinion says that the transient lodging taxes are taxes imposed on any consideration rendered for the sale, service, or furnishing of transient lodging. This would create a new tax in Oregon on the service fee that is charged to the customer for utilization of an online travel service company. So while that may not matter to some people, for the 55 business members that the Independent Lodging Association has in the state of Oregon, including Bend Value Inn, Brookings Inn and Resort, Magnuson Hotel, Budget Inn on Albany, Budget Inn Ontario, you can see the list of all of our Oregon members. This matters greatly to them because it creates an additional tax. They don't have the money to go out and direct market to consumers. They don't have the budget that, say, a Hilton or a Marriott or somebody like that has. So they rely very heavily on online travel companies to provide that marketing service so that they can direct market to consumers that live anywhere across the country or globally who are looking to go to Seaside or Bend or the Dalles or Hood River. This would create, because you're now creating a new tax on the service that these online travel companies provide, you are increasing the rate that customers would have to pay to book for these hotel rooms in the state of Oregon. And I think lastly, there's a concern about whether or not cities are able to recoup the full cost of tourism. If the issue at hand is that rooms are being sold at a specific rate online that is different than what they're being sold if a customer calls the hotel directly, then the government should fix that problem. They should require that all hotel rooms are sold at the rate which hotels sell them directly. And that way consumers would see, if you go online, you book it for this price. If you don't, you don't. That has not happened because that negotiation happens between the online travel company and the hotels that are members of our online travel companies to help them direct market to consumers. So if the issue is the cost of the hotel room, we are remitting the full cost of taxes for the rate at which hotels are telling us to charge for the hotel rooms. The issue is not hidden tax money or lost tax money. If that's the heart of the issue, let's solve that issue. This bill does not do this. I want to clearly state that this bill creates a new tax on the services that are provided by online travel companies, and I would encourage you to vote no on Senate Bill 1519. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I think the real crux of this is when you assess when someone buys the room from Expedia,
mm-hmm.
and there's a 10% tax, Does Expedia, let's say Expedia sells the room for $100, because I'm bad at math.
Me too, thank you.
So Expedia sells the room for $100, and that includes the service fee. Let's say it includes a $20 service fee. So they sell it for $100. They impose the tax on the customer. Is the tax that they impose on the customer on a base of 100 or on a base of 80?
The tax is imposed on the rate at which the hotel quotes the website. So that tax would be assessed on the $80 fee, not the $100 fee, because you can't, in Oregon, under current law, you cannot assess a tax on the service that the online travel company has provided. That's why this broadens the definition of it actually creates a new definition of the tax collector, so that this, the intent of which is to tax the service that is being provided.
So you only tax the customer, because the Restaurant Association and the people who testified with them were under a different impression, that the customer was taxed for the full price that they paid for the room. In other words, if the hotel charges $100 at the door, and Expedia charges $100, does Expedia only levy the tax on $80?
Chair Burdick, that is correct. So we were doing some serious public policy research in the Lobby Message Center yesterday, and I called the Grand Lodge in Salem, and I asked how much it would cost to stay in one of their rooms for tonight, and they quoted me a price of $129. And I was an English literature major and I'm terrible at math, so let's say it's 10%. The tax that I would be charged on that room is $12.90 if I were to book directly through the Grand Lodge. I went on Expedia.com and I put in the Grand Lodge, and they quoted me a price of $129, and the total taxes and fees were $12.90. Why is that? It's because Expedia and the Grand Lodge has agreed to sell rooms at a specific rate when they're selling through Expedia. The sum total of the tax is less than what the customer would pay direct booking through the Grand Lodge itself, because they're buying the room at a slightly reduced rate. But the sum total of the taxes and the fees are $12.90, which are equal to what they would be paying here.
Okay, now I'm confused again. Send
just following up on that,
yeah.
If I'm buying through Expedia, am I being told that I'm paying $12.90 in tax? So my feeling is I'm paying $12.90 in tax, when in fact Expedia is keeping some of that.
Chair Burdick, Senator Telfer, it says taxes and fees total are $12.90.
So it doesn't distinguish one as tax.
That is correct.
Okay.
Okay, other questions? Mazin, the issue has been raised about whether this constitutes a new tax, and have you had any more thoughts on that since we talked yesterday?
Chair Burdick, thank you for your question. I have been trying to answer that question, and frankly, I feel like I've been in intellectual gymnastics mode for the last 48 hours trying to answer that. I think and I'm by no means an expert on this. I think the issue, the way that we read this bill, by creating a new tax collector, what you do is you allow, and then in Section 2 of the bill, it says that on page 2, lines 43 and 44, that's where we read the bill, that there would be a tax collected on the service provided. So I think the transient lodging tax in 2003 was passed that would impose on any consideration rendered for the sale, service, or furnishing of transient lodging. So that's what the tax is rendered for. It doesn't say anything about services or the service that's provided through a travel agent. If they're booking through a travel agent, this law would include independent travel agencies as well as online travel companies. So it depends on your definition of a new tax. This would tax a new service in Oregon, whether or not constitutionally that is a new tax. That's for somebody far smarter than I.
Okay, well, I think that's an issue that bears consideration, but I think what I'm going to do now, unless there are other questions.
Well, if I may, just one more question. You made a claim that this bill would put the independent hotel operators at a significant disadvantage. And I don't understand why, if the selling price to the consumer is the same, whether you go through an OTC or whether you don't go through an OTC.
If you impose a tax on the service that that is provided through the online travel company, that would be a tax in addition to what they're charging now. So the hotels would be either in a situation where they would have to even more discount the price that they sell, that they don't sell the room, that they offer the hotel room through the online travel company, or the customer booking a room through an online travel company would be more expensive than direct booking through the hotel. And you see a lot of independent, the reason that the Independent Lodging Association cares a great deal about this is that they don't have the money to direct market to consumers nationally and globally. They rely very heavily on online travel companies to provide that service to them. So imposing a tax on the service that they're providing those people increases the cost of customers to utilize those websites to book those rooms.
Wouldn't it be the same for the big chains?
Yeah. Yes.
As well?
Chair Burdick, Senator
Still
Morse,
a
that's
level
correct.
Playing field.
The
independents
in terms
are not
of
unfairly disadvantaged by this bill.
Senator Burdick, excuse me, Senator Morse, that's correct. Hotel to hotel, that is an apples and apples increase. I think the question that a lot of our Independent Lodging Association members have is how does that increase affect people who want to come and book their hotel rooms? That's what they're concerned about, because it increases their cost of doing business.
Okay. Any other questions? Committee, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate
Thank
Bill
you.
1519, and I will put it over to Monday, but also there's a real question about whether this can actually be a Senate bill, so we'll be having discussions with our lawyers and our staff and interested parties on that, but I want to put it over to Monday in case there's a need to put anything else on the record. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1531. Your bill is going to be the last one. Welcome, Chris.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1531. Is a familiar bill. It's the annual Reconnect bill. In your packet, you have a draft SMS, and you have a draft revenue impact. The impact is a minimal impact. There wasn't much that happened at the federal level in 2011 that would affect Oregon taxable income. And you also have in your packet information from the Oregon Society of CPAs that provides a summary of individual provisions that were passed at the federal level.
And I'd like to put on the record our appreciation for the CPAs who always come through with intelligent analysis of these reconnects. I'm glad we didn't have to work them too hard this year. We worked them hard enough last year and the year before. So thanks. I see Mr. Douglas and Ms. Buck in the audience. So please thank your clients on our behalf. Do you have anything else to add?
That's it for the bill as drafted.
Okay. All right. I know. So we have an amendment to this bill, which is, do we have that amendment here?
Madam Chair, we do not have the amendment. It's being drafted. The amendment would deal with an issue that has come up with co-ops, and you have some folks from the industry going to testify on that, and the issue relates to a recent interpretation of existing statute by the Department of Department of Revenue, and how in 2005 we disconnected from Section 199 deductions, domestic production activity deduction, and so there's been an add back since 2005, and within the past few months the Department of Revenue has reviewed that language and modified their interpretation of that deduction. And so without belaboring the point, I think some folks here are going to testify and provide you more detail on that.
Let's have our panel of co-op people, John McCulley, Dave Buck, and Daryl Knox. And committee, I think this is probably a good time. I need to take off, so I'm going to turn this whole operation over to our honorable vice chair, Senator Morse. And I will return as soon as I can.
Who wishes to go first?
I'll go first, okay, Mr. Vice Chair. Madam Chair, sorry to miss you here. This obviously won't be as exciting as the last bill you heard, but hopefully will be educational. My name is John McCulley. I'm representing the Agriculture Cooperative Council of Oregon. I have with me to my right Daryl Knox and Dave Buck, who are CPAs and work with cooperatives. And we're here to explain why we would like an amendment to Senate Bill 1531 to do what we think clarifies the intent of the legislature when it disconnected from the Section 199 provision that Mr. Alanak just described to you. The Congress passed in 2004 an act that was intended to encourage domestic production and thereby jobs domestically. In the 2005 legislature, the body determined that it would disconnect from that provision. Since that time, cooperatives have filed their tax returns as if we were indeed disconnected. Then last fall, we received, or some of our cooperative members received notice that the department was looking back at all open tax years and requesting, I guess department doesn't request, they demand that the taxes be paid based on their interpretation of how the state had worded its disconnect. We met with the department in November, provided an analysis of our view of why we thought their interpretation of the statute was incorrect, and then in the middle of December received word that they didn't buy our argument, and we are now before you to see if we can get the clarification. I have to say that all of the interactions we've had with the department have been very cordial. I think they understand the issue clearly that we are trying to correct here. I would even go so far as to say they're sympathetic to what we have been presenting to them. So at this point, we are attempting to, as I say, clarify what it means when we disconnect in this state as it applies to cooperatives. I'm going to have Dave and Daryl explain the mechanics of what is happening now and why we think that the interpretation the department has made is inappropriate public policy, in that it does create a taxation on the same income twice.
Well, I'll go next. My name is Daryl Knox. I'm a CPA from Salem-based AKT CPAs. Senator Morse, Revenue Committee, thank you for having us. We serve ag co-ops in Oregon. I support this amendment to Senate Bill 1531 to clarify the interpretation of Oregon statute to disconnect from federal Section 199 for ag co-ops. This clarification, I think, will correct the inequity of the current interpretation of the Oregon Department of Revenue. It results in only a partial disconnect, and the end of the day, the cooperative receives or is allowed to reduce its taxable income by a different amount than what its members will ultimately pay tax on, and the co-op fundamental from a tax standpoint is that the cooperative is allowed to reduce its taxable income by the amount of taxable income that it allocates to its members. And so that fundamental is being violated here. Oregon is seeking to reduce this reduction by only partial disconnect and still require the members to then pay the higher amount of taxable income via the 1099 that they receive. I'm here in support of the Ag Co-op Council's efforts and to answer questions as necessary, and I'll let my partner Dave Buck describe it a little further.
Thank you. Vice Chair Morris and committee members, my name is David Buck. I'm a CPA with AKT, a CPA firm here in Salem, Oregon, and I also work with cooperative industries and co-ops who are specifically affected by this. As a broad picture, again, just so we're all on the same page, a cooperative entity does its business, makes a profit, and passes that profit via tax reporting, passes that profit on to its patrons, and the patrons pay tax on that. And the concept, both federally and at the Oregon level, is a co-op. The co-op industry, it's a single tax theory. In other words, the co-op doesn't pay tax and then take what's left and give it to its members. It's, the profits are only taxed once. And what's happening here, as John described earlier, this Section 199 deduction that the federal government granted back in 2004-2005, Oregon chose to disconnect from that entirely and not allow for that specific deduction at the state level. And so industry, when they've been dealing with the cooperatives, industry has computed the tax profits of the co-op and the amount that's passed on to the patrons as if Section 199 does not exist. And that's the result we've been using, all of industry and other CPAs, other firms are not just doing it the way we have. That's the way it's been done throughout the state. And with Oregon Department of Revenue's interpretation, the net result changes quite a bit. The net result now, instead of Oregon collecting tax once on cooperative profits, now they are getting a second bite at a portion of those profits because of the way they interpreted the Section 199 disconnect, the very thing that we're here today to ask for clarification through this amendment. So in summary, really, Oregon is supposed to be fully disconnected, and if they're fully disconnected, there should be no adjustments to any of the cooperative amounts that are passed through to the patrons that in this case result in additional taxation to the cooperative. The interpretation is inequitable for those reasons we stated, and I think Daryl mentioned just a moment ago, even the mechanics of how the patrons pay State of Oregon tax, they're required to pay on an amount that the co-op reports to them in full, but then the co-op does not get to under the Oregon Department of Revenue's interpretation, the cooperative does not get to deduct that full amount off of their tax liability. They are limited because of the interpretation of the Department of Revenue. And really, those are the points I wanted to bring up. And if you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Telfer.
Mr. Chair. I believe you have a spreadsheet here in your presentation that I find very helpful. The comparison as to whether, you know, if a co-op has $1 million of profit, they pay tax on $1 million, except for in Oregon, the total tax paid is at $1,090,000. So could you kind of walk...
Yeah, and
briefly on that, yeah, because I think that's the glaring
I'd be happy
out.
To, Vice Chair Morrison, committee members, Senator Telfer. Do you have this sheet? And I apologize. Like most accountants, get a lot of numbers here that we try to follow and we get too detailed sometimes. But I'll explain the big picture of what this is designed to do. The top portion of this, the top gradient portion under version one, is designed to show an example of what the Department of Revenue's current interpretation is, and it contrasts to the bottom portion, which is the way industry has been reporting. If you look at the top portion, the basic concept here is the cooperative. With its activities with its members, has made $1 million. And in the federal column, the top left portion, that $1 million is reduced by the $90,000, which is the Section 199 deduction that we've been talking about, the peculiar deduction that's causing a little bit of the heartburn with both us and the Department of Revenue. So at the federal level, they get to take that amount away, and the $910,000 that's left is what they pass along to their patrons. The patrons pay tax. And at the federal level, the co-op doesn't pay any tax. The patrons pay on all that revenue that's left. Then if you compare that next to it, to just to the right, Oregon comes along, the same $1 million, but Oregon does not get to deduct the Section 199. So you can see it's not deducted. And here's just after that $1 million, what the Department of Revenue says is, we'll let you deduct $910,000 off of that in computing your cooperative level tax. In other words, the state of Oregon is saying, even though we're disconnected from Section 199, we're not going to let you deduct the full $1 million that you've passed along to your patrons. We're only going to let you deduct $910,000, which has been reduced by Section 199, and we're saying Section 199 doesn't exist for state purposes. So when you go through this, if you go clear down to the bottom of that first section, you can see that for federal purposes, we're paying tax on the state is collecting tax on $910,000. Oregon, in our interpretation, they should only be collecting tax on $1 million, adding back the 199 deduction. But in fact, Oregon wants to collect, I mentioned earlier, taking another bite out of the apple. Oregon wants to take charge tax on $1,090,000. $90,000 in the more than the co-op even made in a profit this year. The state of Oregon is saying, we want to tax not just the million, but another $90,000. The lower section, which I probably don't need to go through, is the way we've been reporting, and it reflects at the very bottom. We do understand that for Oregon purposes, we do not get the 199 deduction. So our income's increased by $90,000, but it's not increased by double that, which is what the Oregon Department of Revenue's interpretation says. And as John said earlier, I think the Department of Revenue is somewhat sympathetic, and they understand the plight, but there again, the way that they want to interpret the statute is different from what seems to be common sense to industry and to us, and that is there was no intent to double tax any dollars to cooperatives and their patrons.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Do you have anything else?
No, Mr. Vice Chair, I just wanted to let you know we do have the amendment in the works. I met with Legislative Council yesterday, and we're not sure when it is going to be available, but it is in the queue there.
Okay, thank you. Without further questions, I would extend the offer to the department to offer comments if you wish, John, or okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Committee.
Good morning, Senator Morris, members of the panel. Ken Ross from the Department of Revenue. Of course, we're neutral on this bill. But really what we're seeing from the Department of Revenue is it's a function of the way it's reported. So to simplify the law says if you have a deduction on your federal return, you have to add it back on your Oregon return is what we're saying. And because of the way it's reported on the federal return, even though they pass that deduction to their patrons, it still shows on the federal return. So we're saying you still have to add it back. So, like I said, we're neutral on this, but we don't think an amendment is unreasonable for clarification.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1531 and carry it forward to Monday. And the last bill on our agenda is 1529. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1529, and I don't see the list of those that are testifying.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1529 is a committee bill. It's actually Christine's bill, but I've sent her down to work on some new estimates on the senior property tax deferral. Here she is, right here. Okay, so I'll let Christine come up.
Thank you.
You could lead us through the bill, please.
Certainly. Chair Morris, Senate Bill 1529 essentially reclassifies a number of industrial and commercial properties into different classes, and this would affect the change property ratio. Of course, the change property ratio is applied to any new construction or improvements on existing construction, and that would be the assessment value. And so there is an impact on revenue due to this change. Moving the categories around often has different impacts on this change property ratio. You can see that the revenue impact is around $150,000 in 2011-13, moving up to more like $800,000 in the next biennium, and then beyond that, up to roughly $1.3 million in 2015-17. And this is because of ongoing growth in new properties being constructed and having that new change property ratio applied to them. The locally assessed industrial would often see a decline in revenues and change property ratios, but there are a number of other categories that offset that revenue decline, and you can see the net impact on the, in the far right column after everything is accounted for.
So the net impact is a positive revenue rather than a negative revenue impact, the cumulative effect over time. Any comments or questions from staff before we call up Drew Hagedorn and Steve Wells, please? Maybe you could lead us through the reasons, summary of the reasons and...
You bet, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, committee members, and appreciate you earmarking one of your five committee bills for this purpose. For the record, my name is Drew Hagedorn. I'm appearing today on behalf of NAOP, the National Association of Industrial and Office Properties, which is the industry association for commercial real estate developers. To frame the issue for you, back in 2011, we first brought this issue before the committee in the form of Senate Bill 818. The goal of that legislation was to address an impact, a detrimental impact on the assessment of, in particular, commercial warehouse-based property after a Department of Revenue administrative rule took effect and significantly increased the assessed value of those properties such that it put it at a competitive disadvantage as against existing properties and therefore created a disincentive for new development. That legislation, it became quickly apparent, really wasn't ready for prime time. We didn't have the data to support the concept, and so this committee instructed the stakeholders to sit down and come up with a consensus proposal, and we believe with the Dash 2 amendments, the bill before you is a consensus proposal. I'd like to thank at the outset this committee for its interest and also the Multnomah County Assessor, Randy Waldriff, as well as the Department of Revenue and John Phillips for really getting the county assessors around the table and getting us the data that we needed to instruct this decision. So I'm going to turn now to Steve Wells, who's going to talk a little bit more about the proposal in greater detail, but I think the point that I want to drive home is that this does not apply retroactively, rather it applies prospectively, and by that I mean that it applies to new properties coming onto the tax rolls, not existing structures, so there would be no need for existing commercial properties to be reassessed. So with that, I'll turn to Steve and let him walk through the remainder of the bill.
Thank you, Drew, and thank you to the committee for hearing this bill. I want to, you have, should have in front of you a several page presentation. I'll go through it as briefly as I can. Includes some background on Measure 50, and I'm sure you know much of it. How the changes from 2008 affected it, an overview of the bill, and how we think it affects the CPR going forward. In background on page 2, Measure 50 created a limit on the growth of assessed values to 3% a year on any one property, creating a term called maximum assessed value. Since Measure 50, with the exception of recent years, for the most part, properties that we deal with, typically commodity industrial properties, office properties, retail properties, they are appreciating properties historically, and they have appreciated for many years more than 3%. So what happened is you get real market values and assessed values. There's a big difference in those in most counties and in most products. It's different than state appraised industrial plants that don't have that same. They tend to depreciate over time once you put in property and equipment. In order to keep existing new properties competitive and fairly treated versus the existing properties whose assessed values are way lower than their market values, Measure 50 created the change property ratio to try to keep them on an even playing field when you do something that changes the way a property is assessed, typically new construction, a rezoning, something that adds, it's a fundamental change in the property that requires it to be brought on the tax rolls. And that CPR is determined annually in aggregate for property classes. So going to page 3, we just did a little graphic we presented this to our constituents as well at NAIOP, but you've got a bunch of existing properties whose real market values have grown in excess of their assessed values. Those are then aggregated by class to create a CPR for a class, and then as you bring on in the far right column an individually changed property, you apply that same ratio to the new value of that property so that you try to keep them treated fairly with the existing properties. On page 4, we started seeing the changes. I'm not exactly sure when the administrative rule went into effect, but we started seeing the changes in the real estate community in 2008. And by the way, I don't know if I introduced, I'm with Trammell Crow Company. We're a developer of both office, retail, and industrial properties in Portland. We're a national company, but active in the Portland area for many years. With the changes in 2008, many of the counties, or some of the counties at least, were classifying the kinds of properties we deal with on the industrial side, warehouse properties, light industrial properties that are investor-owned and traded, as commercial. And part of that, I believe, was because they didn't have the same dynamics as industrial property with heavy plants. They really act more like, the way their values grow, they act more like commercial properties do. So that despite the fact that we called them industrial real estate, some counties grouped them with commercial. In 2008, the new DROR rules came through, and those could no longer be grouped as commercial. They had to be put in the industrial category, and that put them into, you know, big manufacturing plant categories, which changed the way the CPR worked. And what it did is, for instance, in Multnomah County, it dramatically increased the CPR versus having been grouped with commercial in the past. And that is negative for our industry. It's negative for job creation because it puts a damper on new development. It's negative generally for economic development because our economy really needs a solid and vibrant warehousing sector to support retail activity. Light industrial is a big employer. In fact, adding jobs more quickly than many other industries in Portland right now. So we think it's a drag on the Portland economy in total. If you go to page 5, we just created an example in Multnomah County as an example. And we said, okay, there's a $20 million industrial property, and let's say it's coming on online in 2011-12 tax year. So pre-2008, that $20 million property would have had a CPR of 0.488. Well, yeah, I think using the pre-2008 method, that would have had a 0.4883 CPR, and so you would have ended up with $9.8 million of assessed value. With the new method going forward, where you group that property in with industrial, the CPR is 84%, and so you would have ended up with $16,752,000 on the assessed value for that same property. The next door $20 million property that's been around probably is assessed roughly around the $9.8 million. So you've got two properties of equal value, same product type, and the one that's brand new has 71% higher assessed value and 71% higher taxes consequently. So and that's a fundamentally, I mean, that's just a huge disparity, makes it difficult to bring new product to market. We support the Bill 1529 with the Dash 2 amendments. And I want to go over give the overview of it real quickly on page 6. In terms of assessment, this only affects assessments on changed properties, not on existing properties, which would be a very complicated endeavor. The main changes it does, it moves state-appraised industrial, which we refer to probably as heavy industrial, into a separate class, and those are assessed and have different value. We think that's good policy because the properties just act fundamentally different in value. It moves machinery and equipment to a separate class and a separate tax account. The remaining industrial property is combined with commercial into one class, and again, we think they have very similar characteristics in real market value and assessed value and how those relationships work. It returns the assessed values for changed industrial grade property kind of back to the way it was before in most cases. And so it corrects something that had become an imbalance. And then just to make clear, the effective date, I believe, is starting with tax year that begins July 12 and does not apply retroactively and the complications that would bring. It also has some collection changes, which affect all properties with separately identified machinery and equipment. In summary, it allows county collectors to use personal property collection methods on that machinery equipment piece, as well as the current tools they have in the real estate tax foreclosure passages. And I think that's best to look at those on page 7. The current structure of the tax code, if you've got a building with an owner owns some real estate, and then there's a tenant that owns machinery and equipment, which is in a separate account. If the tenant doesn't pay their bills, the counties can only foreclose on the tenant's property, not the owner's property, which is a very, very complicated thing to try to go through. It takes a long time, and it's just a very unwieldy because it's not the kind of property that you think of being foreclosed. It's not really truly pure real estate. The new proposal would allow, and you can see the changes in red, on the tenant M&E side, the counties would now have personal property rules that they could move much more quickly, and I don't know, I haven't been on the wrong end of that, so I don't really know what that means, but it seems fair to me and to our constituents. On the owner side, since you now have your real property and you may have some separately identified machinery and equipment, that machinery and equipment piece would also be subject to those personal property collection techniques. And in order to not go backwards on the current rights that the counties have, if it's that owner M&E count that's delinquent, you could still foreclose on that and the whole real property, which is consistent with how with the abilities they have today. And finally, the last slide is for the reporting counties. We didn't get information from all the counties, but this last table gives you three columns by county that is reported. What the pre-bill industrial, without the bill, I guess I really should say, without the bill, what would the industrial CPR be for industrial and commercial, and then what is the combined CPR? And it's not just the combination of the classes, it's the removal of the machinery and equipment, the removal of the state-appraised industrial. So, for example, I used the example with Multnomah County earlier. Industrial is 83.83 right now, commercial would be 49.12, and the combined would be 52.15. And as someone who develops office retail and industrial, although that's a slight increase in what the commercial would have been without the bill, it's a few percent, and it wouldn't dissuade. It has no economic development impact. It's a new property. It wouldn't have ever caught our attention to have on the industrial side to have anything like that kind of a change in the CPR, and frankly, it's going back to where it was before. So we think that's to have the commercial go up a little bit, but have the industrial, you know, resolve a 70% problem is good tax policy and overall good for the development industry and the economy. Another example would be, I was going to use a now. There's multiple examples that you can pull out here. In Linn County, industrial would be one. The commercial would be 71, and combined they're 75%. So very similar for the commercial, but solves a big problem for the industrial. And if you had an old warehouse that's coming off a tax exemption or has been newly built, and it comes off this year, it's going to receive this more favorable treatment. And again, it's not more favorable than it used to be. It's returning it back to something more like it was before. So we'll be happy to take questions and appreciate your hearing
Mr. Chair, the bill. If I may, we did reach out to other external stakeholders, including Associated Oregon Industries, the Port of Portland, the Building Owners and Managers Association, and they're all asked me to express their support for this concept with the Dash 2 amendments.
Okay, great. Questions? Comments? Things are looking pretty good.
Okay.
Great. Okay.
Thank you.
If you have nothing more, is there anyone else that the department, I assume, would have some comments? Counties? Welcome anybody additionally.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Committee. Thank you.
Good morning, Senator Morris and members of the committee. My name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue, and I'm coming up today because I expressed concerns about the bill last session in 2011, and we weren't concerned so much with what the bill, the intent of the bill. It was this how it went about it, and so we're here to say that, first of all, the department is neutral on the bill, as we are with all legislation, and But the method by which this accomplishes the goal that was sought last session is administratively acceptable to us in terms of not creating problems. The whole classification issue, as I explained last session and to you privately in some meetings, was that we use this classification system to appraise over 1 million kinds of property per year as required by the law. And the only way we can do that is through this mass appraisal system. And so we have this classification system. The Measure 50 came along and co-opted that classification system and said, oh, and by the way, we're going to use that in order to determine what the taxable value on new property is. And that's the part that really creates this inequity for companies that exist versus companies that are just coming in. So we adopted this dreaded rule, this terrible administrative rule, but the purpose of it was to deal with our appraisal side, and it did have some effects. And so this is just another way we're trying to work with Measure 50 in dealing with all these non-uniform situations that keep occurring. So anyway, I just want to let you know that this resolves the issues that I had last session.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Any questions?
Just a comment. You know, Measure 50, we constantly nitpick, fix this. You know, I really like to see us just tackle re-looking at it instead of just trying to fix it, you know, one sentence at a time every session, or a few sentences.
We could just take that on with comprehensive tax reform.
There you go.
And just
I mean, we're fixing it, but, you know, it's tedious, slow, and very piecemeal.
System that doesn't work the best.
Yeah.
And finally, if I might, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I did submit a statement that just basically reiterates that and that we believe the legislation simply addresses the classification for the purposes of the changed property ratio and doesn't change how we appraise property or that concept at all. So I just wanted to get that in the record. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay.
Hearing no further comments or requests for testimony, we will close the public hearing and carry this bill forward to Monday with the expectation that we move the Dash 2s and move the bill. So with that,